Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that registrations will be opening very soon for my next 12-week transformation program. Stepping Out from Behind the Smile is an immersive container that guides you through my holistic transformation model, helping you to step off the hamster wheel and start living a life you love. Whether you're looking to address your relationship with food, alcohol, money, or relationships, this program is designed to give you the tools you need to create a meaningful life on purpose. If you're interested in finding out more, you can DM me the word ready, or alternatively, you can contact me through my website and we'll set up a time to connect. It's important I let you know that these groups run at limited numbers. Now, I do this intentionally so that it's an intimate space for you to do the deep inner work. But because of this, spots are limited and the April intake is already filling up. I can't wait to see you inside the container for a life-transforming experience. Now let me tell you about today's episode. Joining me in the studio is Dom McKenna. Dom and I share a similar story in that we both have family in recovery. However, Dom decided to get sober a lot earlier than I did. In many ways, Dom has grown up in recovery, and we had a fascinating conversation around how he uses the tools he's learned in sobriety to apply to all areas of his life today. We also had a great conversation around being in a relationship with a sober alcoholic, another similarity that we share, and I was able to pick Dom's brain on how to nurture a long-term relationship. We also touched on some controversial topics, including whether or not you should stay anonymous in recovery and the fallacy around work-life balance. I absolutely loved this conversation. Dom is a brilliant speaker, and I just know that you will hear something that will help you today. If you love the episode, don't forget to rate it, review it, and of course, share it. And with that, let's kick off today's episode. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. Today, here in the studio with me, I have Dom McKenna. Dom is a husband, father, and business owner from Melbourne. He and his wife, Karina, who is also a friend of the show, run a business through three countries. They are fitness advocates and spend time creating memories with their two beautiful daughters. Now, I first saw Dom roaming around the rooms of recovery a little while ago now. Basically, you've been there a lot longer than I have, but I've seen you pretty much from when I first moved down to Melbourne, and I've heard you share a few times, and I've always really, really wanted to invite you onto the show. So for me, it feels like this has been a long time coming. For you, I only approached you a little while ago, so you're probably thinking, what is she talking about here? But without any further delay, I would love to invite and welcome Dom into the studio and onto the show. Dom, welcome to Behind the Smile. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure. How's your day been so far?
Today's been good. Up early. I was up at 4:50 this morning. Off to travel to Perth tomorrow, so I had a lot of things going on in the head and awake.
That is early. Were you training or literally just getting work done out of your mind and onto a piece of paper?
Just woke up and was like, we've got stuff, we've got a plan. So
Wow, my goodness. Wow, thank you so much for making the time to, be here.
And I saw my wife on this a few months back, and I was maybe mid last year, and I was like, wow, firstly, she's incredible, but secondly, you're a great interviewer. And I thought, wow, you really know how to pull it out of people. So looking forward to the chat.
Thank you so much, Dom. I'm really excited to have this conversation today. You got sober at a really, really young age. It was 2008. You were 22 years old. So you've essentially grown up in the rooms of recovery.
That's right.
But then you also had this big, beautiful life outside of recovery. So I'm really excited to talk about both of those elements here today. Before we go any further, though, I'd love for our audience to get to know you a little bit better. So can we start with, what does an average day look like? Where do you live? And what do you do for fun?
Awesome. Questions. Average day. Well, I don't get up at 4:50 every day, that's for sure. Average day. So both my wife and I operate a business from home. So we've been doing that for a number of years now and in the entrepreneurial space. So a lot of our stuff is, it's actually quite customized. So we will, I'm a big gym person. So we do a lot of CrossFit, a lot of jiu-jitsu, all that. And yeah, we've customized our life. So we've got a lot of space, but hang out with our kids. Kids obviously at school. I'm doing planning, business structure, coaching, mentoring, whatever it is, strategy stuff. And yeah, pretty full life. I don't use the word busy. I think when your boss is lording over you like my one used to when I worked in law, that's when you're busy. But when you create your own life and you want on your calendar, you have a full life. So we have a very full life. And what do I do for fun? Hang out with my wife, watch a lot of movies. We're massive movie people, although we limit it to certain nights, date nights, and so on. A lot of fitness. And yeah, I spend time with people. I'm a mad extrovert. So I will, I spend huge amounts of time with people. My wife is slightly extroverted, mainly introverted, which if you understand the difference, extrovert is like I can go for 4 days and have 10 hours charge time and go for another 4 days. She can go for 4 hours and needs an hour's charge time and then 4 hours and an hour's charge time.
Yeah, it's exactly like my partner and I. I'm definitely the extrovert in the relationship, whereas he's much more introverted and definitely finds being around groups of people really depletes his battery, whereas I can get that charge from those environments.
Yep. I don't need much charge. Yeah. I'm like, maybe I'm solar or something. Like I just need a little bit of sun. I'm good to go again.
Yeah. And you and your wife, Karina, have been together a long time, right?
Yeah. We've been married since 2012. Been together since 2010. So yeah, a little while now. It's good.
Wow. So you guys met, would have been what, 2 years sober then?
Yep. Wow. Yeah, when I met her in the program, I was 2 years sober. It took me 3.5 months to, no, nearly 4 months to ask her to develop the courage to ask her out on a date. She came into a meeting. She was wearing a red turtleneck, white sneakers, glasses, looked like Jerry Seinfeld. She walked into a meeting and I was like, oh man, it just blew my mind. You know, when you get like that feeling in your stomach, the butterflies, still get that.
Oh, and, that's beautiful.
Yeah, she rolls into a meeting and I was like, wow. So I went and met her and chatted and I was like, her energy is just, you met her. She's incredible. Yeah. And now where she is, she's a powerful force. Back then, she was in her early 20s and we met and I was recommended not to, meet someone in early sobriety and don't date them.
Let's go down that rabbit hole for a minute, because for anyone listening that perhaps isn't in recovery or doesn't understand some of the guidelines, some of the suggestions that are made, one of the suggestions that's made is to not date in early sobriety, which is considered, 2 years is still early. They definitely say the first 12 months is a no-go. But also in addition to that, I've heard don't date in the rooms because it can get messy, there's a breakup, then maybe you stop going to certain meetings or it can impact your recovery in a negative way.
All of that comes with good intention. Mm. All of that comes with helping people get well. And the problem is when I first came into recovery, I wasn't well. Like I was alcoholism. You take away the alcohol, I had still had all the isms, issues, all the obsessiveness, all the stuff. And so when someone's really new in the program, what I find is they're vulnerable. They are vulnerable. We're all vulnerable because we're trying to live a life without substances. And so when someone's really early, like I get like, hey, stay away from Newcastle. I totally get that. Mm. At the same time, I met her, developed a relationship. That's why it works so well. We started developing a friendship over a few months. So thankfully, my lack of courage paid off a bit. We got along. We had the same sense of humor. We loved Jim Carrey. There was all these little things where we were like, wow, we love spending time together. Then when I worked up the courage to say, hey, do you want to come on a date? Well, firstly, I said, do you want to come watch this movie at my house? It was Get Him to the Greek with Russell Brand. You know that one? Stroke the fairy wall. So I said, come watch this movie at my place. And she goes, just give me the DVD.
Oh.
And I was like, no, come, I'll pick you up, come watch it. She goes, just give it to me at a meeting. Like, it's all good. I was like,
she was not picking up what you were putting down.
Get the vibe. And I was like, no, I'll pick you up, come watch it, it'll be great. She's like, okay. I'm like, yes. Anyway, that was the start.
That was the beginning. That was
the beginning. So blossoming. I get that with not in the program at all. Well, I mean, that's a bit extreme. But then again, that's just an opinion. So someone might say, oh, not at all anybody. I think we're just trying to protect people. Like, you don't want to blow up your life by, because some people are a bit nuts too. Like, they come in and they're not grounded. And it's like, wow, now two people break up. They don't want to go to meetings. Now someone can't get sober.
Yeah.
I get it. But at the same time, I was told not to because the guy that was telling us liked her. Oh. So there's always human agenda in that too. He was single.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that it worked in my favor.
Well done. I'm glad you followed your gut on that one.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
So Dom, the format of this show is we talk about a time in your life where you were hiding behind a smile. And I've asked you to prepare a photo for today.
which you did. You shared that across. Thank you so much for that. I remember I emailed you straight back and said, baby Dom. You look so young in this photo, but it's always amazing to see people's photos when they share them across. So what I'd love to do now is could you please describe for the listeners the photo that you've chosen and talk about this time in your life where you were hiding behind a smile. So you were presenting one version of yourself to the outside world, but the reality was you were struggling on the inside.
It's interesting. That was one moment that I was hiding behind a smile. But we all hide behind smiles, even now.
Absolutely.
Like there's been times in the last year where like my dad got quite sick with leukemia. I had a heap of stuff going on. Like through lockdowns, like we were all hiding behind smiles, like, yeah, it's all good. And we're trying to reinforce that we're going to get through it. And we're trying to have a positive mental attitude when a lot of times we're hiding behind that and we're struggling, we're grinding, but we're fighting through it. So I still struggle behind a smile. I might've done that in the last month. You know, It's going to happen sometimes. But back to that photo. So I was 19. I was actually at a nightclub on the Gold Coast called My Bar. Great spot. Actually, we used to have incredible DJs come in there, Carl Cox,
And
I was nightclub promoting at the time, funnily enough. So I was working in law, but I was doing nightclub promoting. That's when I realized. It only took me working in law for 1 year to realize this is not my profession. Like this isn't contracts, it's soul destroying for me. I need to be with people talking, promoting, doing these things where I could, you know, add value to people. That was just my journey. But you see that picture at that time, I'm having a lot of fun, but behind that, I'm actually a hostage. I was a hostage in my own life to addiction. I was 19 and I was using significant amounts of recreational drugs, drinking an exorbitant amount. In fact, I was the guy that would go out and party. I would start the party. I would organize the party, if you know what I mean. I'd get everything in order. And then what would happen is it'd be 3 a.m. Then we had 3 a.m. lockouts. Remember that? Lockout laws. That was crazy. But 5 a.m., if you stepped out at 3 a.m., you couldn't get back in. So you stay in where you were, 5 a.m. stay to wherever. But the thing is, everyone else would go home because that's what a reasonable person does. But
I've heard.
I'm unreasonable. Exactly. I'm unreasonable because I'm an addict. Once I start, I can't stop until something stops me. And normally that's like being awake for 2 or 3 days. So I would keep going and I would go and find people keep going. Remember, I always find this funny about people who drink recreationally and party recreationally. They would say, man, I went on a bender. That term?
Oh, yeah.
But they meant they went out, stayed out late, and then they went home and went to bed. And probably got up and was like, oh, hangover, smoothie. And like, it's not a competition, but I hear that and I'm like, oh, like I would bend days, not bend the night. Like I would bend the days into like 2 nights would become the night. And so that's the problem with addiction is normal people don't do that. I say normal people, normal recreational party fun goers don't do that. Whereas you and I are not like that. We have the gene. I think it's genetic. Some people don't agree with that, but I can take you through my entire lineage if you want, especially Irish people. We've got it all in our veins. And so I would just continue to push the barrier. It was too much and never enough. That could literally be, if I had a biography, I think it was someone's, but too much and never enough was always, I was always chasing more, the addiction of more of everything. I'm always looking for more. Even now, you know, it's wild. I've still got it in me, like another caffeinated beverage and another this. So I've got to temper that stuff. So I was hiding behind, I was hostage to not being able to free myself of, once I started, I couldn't stop. And then I would come home after a weekend out and I would have people ringing me that I owed money to, have all these missed calls. And I just had this chaos that I could barely remember because I'd gone on a 2 or 3 day bender, but I couldn't stop. That was what I was hostage to. So I was having fun, but I was also scared, insecure, and felt like I had this momentum that just wouldn't stop and it was bad.
Yeah, it sounds like the power of choice had been removed.
Yeah.
So tell me, when did you start drinking? When did this all begin?
Some of the stuff that I've learned is that environment dictates performance. And we hear about the term environmental. People go, well, the ocean. No. Environmental, like we're in an environment together right now where we're talking about, and we're in a safe environment. It's contextual. So environ, let's separate it, mental. So your environment affects you mentally. So when I was 13, I changed schools. I went from a school on the Gold Coast, seven different schools. And the second last one I went to, I was in year seven and I started hanging out with the year nines. And then when I went to go into year eight, I started hanging out with the year tens because they'd gone up a year, I'd gone up a year. And I started skateboarding with them. And then one of them pulled out a bong and was like, hey, this is cool. It's something to do. And I want to get the approval of people that are older than me. I want to be the cool kid. I'll listen to Slipknot. I'll listen to this. I'll listen to the worst music, but I will listen to Limp Bizkit. Absolutely. Still listen to it now. I'll do stuff to get accepted into a group. So I smoked a bong. By the way, I hated marijuana.
Same.
The worst. Like
I could
the
never.
Worst.
It just made me really hungry and hungry, really paranoid. Tired.
Paranoid, tired, hungry, and just I'd lay on the couch, just like oh, this
I
is awful.
I never got it, and I dated a lot of weed smokers.
Yeah. Anyway. And from an and it's, now it's very popular these days. People love it, and I get it. It chills you back, you relax, or whatever. But I'm an up guy, not a down guy.
Same.
Still yeah. now, right? Mm. And so I got to watch out for the stuff that takes me too high, because I'm not someone who's like, oh, I should be more yang, not ying, or whatever,
yeah,
whatever it is.
More.
So anyway, I start doing that. That was my first introduction to, hey, have a joint. And you remember the old South Park thing? Marijuana is a gateway drug. Mr. Mackey. So anyway, I start smoking weed, and then that leads to, I would say, drinking. What are you drinking at that age? Like a Woodstock here or this there?
UDLs.
Jim Beam, UDL.
Yes.
Oh, the UDLs, how good were they?
Ruskies.
Yep. Woodstocks were a big one. Jim Beam and Coke and all that, but I stepped more into the drug use. And so there was drinking, but then there was very much that, and that was, you know, 14, 15. And so then I went off to boarding school, which is probably the best thing my parents could have ever done. They understood the environmental game. So they went, he's around the wrong crowd on the Gold Coast, which is very easy to do. Sunny place for shady people. So they pulled me out of the environment, put me into a different one, sent me off to boarding school in Victoria. That's why I live here now. And put me around the right environment that sort of took me out of all the craziness. And so I got, but I also think too, I was raised really well. Now I know some people have had very tough upbringings. I had a really good upbringing. Incredible parents taught me really good values and principles and reinforcement and just parented me really well. Right. Now I don't like saying that some people go, I had a crappy childhood. It's like, well, that's, you know, I can't speak to that. I can speak to I had a good one, so that when I went through a really crappy time, the root system my parents had built in me, the values and principles, was so strong that even though the weather in my life was terrible, the tree didn't come out of the ground.
Mm.
And part of that was taking me out of the environment, putting me a good one, but it didn't alleviate me of my addictive nature. So when I came back from that to the Gold Coast for school breaks and all that, all that stuff started again.
I think it's so important to share that story, because we do so often hear there was a problematic childhood, maybe an absentee parent, and as a result, the isms are developed. But what you're saying is my parents did all the right things, but this is a genetic predisposition that I carry, which was later activated.
Have you ever heard the term with health, right? I always think it's funny when people say to me, I've got really good genes and they don't eat great or they whatever it is. It's like, yeah, well, genetics loads the gun, but your lifestyle pulls the trigger. We get that. So you can have a loaded gun there, but if the lifestyle's not put to you, the gun is not going to go off. So, for example, part of the issue was, sure, I've naturally got the predisposition to addictive nature tendencies, whatever you want to call it, addiction, alcoholism, whatever it is, that then I went into the environment, which then easily brought it out, and then it was reinforced. And so my parents moved me out of the environment, thankfully, but I had a great upbringing, like a phenomenal upbringing. And many people do. You see the private school kids go off the rails, maybe the parents, different reasons, maybe not a crappy childhood, the absentee, but my parents were all good and all there, but it didn't matter because, like, I'm a social extrovert. I want to get out. I want to meet people. Throw a drug in front of me. Wow, now I've got attention. All of that. So, I'm with you. So good childhood, but at the same time, the environment didn't help.
And so you went to boarding school and, by all accounts, did reasonably well to be able to get into law.
That's why I went to Bond Uni and took a huge loan, because when you don't do great in your enter school, I got like a 70. 71, maybe,
oh, wow.
Yeah, 71. Yeah, people think I got a 99.94. I'm like, no. Took an $80,000 loan from John Howard, and I went to the university you can pay to get into, Bond Uni. That was a fair bit of debt too. That's like $120 in today's dollars.
Yeah.
I went to Bond Uni, somehow got through. I got an incredible memory.
Okay.
I'm not going to talk myself up too much in any degree, but I'm very sure of one thing. I have an incredible memory.
That's your strength.
My retention of information and the ability to recall, it's nearly photographic.
And that's what a lot of law is, right?
Yep. Yep, yeah. So I can remember all the case stuff, movie, this. Someone the other day was like, what was this, that person's name that this thing happened to? She was from the States in Baltimore. I'm like, bang, I knew the name straight away.
Wow.
She was like, whoa. And I said, it's just everyone's got their little superpower. That's mine.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so you were able to, well, in that case, I imagine that, would you have described yourself as being high functioning?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. But also because I got through a law degree, which is, by the way, a very difficult degree. Like the amount of memory, but every degree, in my opinion, is memorizing and repeating.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. And
mm-hmm.
then you get the frame receipt, which is what a degree actually is. It's like, hey, you went here, you paid here, you got there, whatever. Some people are like, oh, that's not, it's exactly what it is, because uni wasn't free unless you had a scholarship. You still paid for your time with it. So with your time for it. So I got through the degree, but I also had the right people around me that I could get the right information from, notes from, gathering and all that. But I cannot believe a law degree. Seriously, with you. I remember one semester coming into the sixth week of equity and trust and evidence law. I mean, they are the hardest subjects. And week six, I was like, I need to start going to class. Like, I don't even know where I am. I'm in the middle of this intense addiction. But I got through it. So you can be high functioning.
Mm.
Yeah, but very, very challenging period of time.
Yeah, I relate to
but
that
when
a lot.
When you're 19, bend it like Beckham and the next day show up.
Huh?
Where was it? I had food poisoning a couple of months ago in Sydney. I went down to Cronulla. People gave me oysters. Like the fifth time I had it in my life. So sick. My mate called the ambulance. He couldn't eat. It was so bad. And the next morning, I'd had like 5 hours sleep. I woke up and I was like, gosh, this is what a hangover used to feel. I haven't had a hangover in 15 years. Oh. But this is what a hangover felt like, right? And when you're 37, you do not recover. That took me like 3 days to get over just that, not let alone like pounding my liver with drugs and alcohol.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I feel like I got to about 30 and that's when I couldn't, the hangovers felt like they were going to kill me. And I kept drinking for another 2 years after that. I was like,
do you know what's so pathetic about being old, in my opinion, older, more mature, is look at us these days. Like, I used to be like, I go out to a, this is such an overshare. My kids might hear this one day. But you go out to a club, you meet someone and you're like, yeah, man, yeah, I'll take that. I'll do that. I'll do this. Yeah, pass me this drink. You never know what's in nothing. 100%. These days, I'm like, oh my gosh, there's too much vitamin B and folate in that. Oh my gosh. Oh, is that a methylated paraben? Oh my gosh, parabens I've heard on the internet about. And we start to, like, you know what I mean? Oh, I can't use anything that's got it. Shut up. Shut up. The stuff you used to, you're cooked. Like,
totally.
Time's ticking for all of us.
Yeah. I definitely wasn't caring when I was putting things up my nose that
exactly
created a burning sensation.
Yeah, and now I'm like using a nasal strip to open my nose so I can sleep better and tape my mouth and doing all the Huberman protocols in the morning and night. And I'm like, what a loser.
You know what, though? It's a good life, though.
It is a good
life. I feel a lot better today than I did in my 20s. That's for sure.
I feel great, but I just laugh at how this standard of like, is that got gluten?
Yeah.
Is that got gluten in it? Like, what are you talking about, man? I used to like wake up and still have KFC around me. You know what I mean?
Surrounding the bed. Yeah. My partner shares about that as well. He's like, I'd wake up and there'd just be like half eaten McDonald's in the bed, because when you're drunk and you're on your way home, you like order way more food than you need.
That's
and
right.
Then you pass out halfway through.
Exactly. Now it's like, is that grass-fed beef? You know, it's just pathetic.
Oh, my goodness, so true. Okay, let's go back for a moment. I want to understand a little bit more. You know, 22 is a young age to get clean and sober. So I'm thinking there must have been some pretty dire consequences going on for you to make that decision at such a young age.
Yep.
What did it look like?
And I'll tell you about how I got sober too. So blow your mind.
I'd love to
I think it'll blow your mind. Mine was like, it's such intensity, right? So I started partying and all that when I was like 13, 14, but I was off at school. So you can only do it sporadically, right? Then I'd come over holidays, crazy bender, get away with it all. I was pretty covert, so I could keep a lot of it under the radar, but my parents knew. My dad's been in recovery, sober for 47 years. But so he got sober 1 year after Anthony Hopkins. Amazing. Like the OGs, right? And in terms of like longevity.
Yeah,
and
that's amazing.
It's not a competition either, by the way, but longer term, he's got wisdom, experience.
I think what's also really cool about your dad is he still comes to meetings.
Oh, yeah, like, all the time.
Yeah,
and he gets
shares
so much from
that
it.
Wisdom and part, yeah, beautiful.
He does. He still gets a lot from it. And people go, why do you still go to meetings? It's like, you know, why do you still do things that help with your spiritual life? Why do you meditate 50 years of meditation? It's his meditation.
Mm.
He comes, he sits, he listens, he contributes. I just find that so funny. People go, do you still go to those? I'm like, do you still go to the gym? Do you still stretch? Do you still do this? It's like all these things are helping with our spiritual pliability.
Yes.
But we can't translate that.
It's a beautiful way to explain it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think some people go, if you're still going at 10 years, like it must not work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the assumption. Oh, no, quite contrary.
Oh, you can't live without it, hey? Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Geez, you must be like, you must have issues still. I'm like, I absolutely do. I absolutely do. And if I don't go, you're going to get the email that's in my draft folder. That's the consequence these days, is like, I'm going to get wound up about something because I'm not working on my spiritual pliability. Pliability is obviously muscle length, you know, being, you do Pilates and yoga and all that stuff, I'm sure. And so all that stuff helps, you know, so that when I've got to pick up a couch, I don't do my back in. Well, hey, when my couch in AA is when I have some conflict with someone or a disagreement, that I listen and I seek first to understand. And I was like, oh, let's unpack, let's talk about that versus going, you're a dickhead. And me costing myself a whole relationship or me doing something I later regret. That's all the stuff now. That's my spiritual, where the recovery comes in. It's not like we have a disagreement and I go, man, I really need a Xanax or I really need to drink. That's not even in my periphery now.
Mm.
Now, could it be? Absolutely. That's why I stay right on top of it. But for me, it's much more like I will blow my life up relationships-wise by overreacting and being a nut. Whereas when I've meditated spiritually, meaning going to meetings, doing the work, all the stuff, I'm much more present. You say something, I can go, huh, interesting, I'll come back to you on that. Go and process, come back 2 days later rather than just bang. That's the difference. Mm. But your question was?
The consequences. What did that look like?
It's funny because everyone's got the story of like this thing blow up, this is terrible, but like I really started hitting it hard from 18 when I graduated school, Gold Coast. I mean, access is everywhere. Why my daughters are not growing up on the Gold Coast.
Mm.
Now, if you listen to this from the Gold Coast, be vigilant. Got to be vigilant because it's party central. It's like your kids growing up in Cancun. It's everywhere and 24/7
schoolies
to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so back then it was even it was intense. Let's put it that way. And so 18 to 22, so that was full pelt. So I was at university, but I had access. My brother was 6 years older, so he knew that crowd and get me into this bar and this thing. So it was wild. I had a car accident when I was 16. Nothing to the degree of Karina's. Karina's was significantly life altering. I drove a palm tree. Yeah, I was like, whoa, big night, we're driving a palm tree.
In your mind, you were driving a palm tree.
So I drove a car at about 80 kilometers an hour, a T intersection, into a palm tree, and the palm tree went through a brick wall with a lady sitting next to me. And so and I got arrested, put on the front page of the Gold Coast Bulletin. That's not a hard thing. And so so that was bad. So I lost my license. I didn't have suspended this, all that, fines. I had to go get a part-time job to pay my fine off and all that. That was the first like, oh, I can't contain, it was 2003. I can't contain my drinking and drug use and all that. Like it's bang. And then it got progressively worse and worse because the disease gets progressively worse and worse. And by the time I was 22, I had started burning so many relationships in my life. And not only that, there was a certain element of society that was starting to infiltrate our life on the Gold Coast, meaning the wrong crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And that was starting to have dire consequences because, again, environment dictates performance. Well, I've got the wrong people in my life now. Bad things are starting to happen. And there's so many things that had happened at the time. Car accidents, money I owed people, so much drama and chaos.
Mm.
But it became normal.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you live in addiction, you're in drama and chaos and you think that it's normal when it's not.
Yeah.
Like you can live this life of peace and harmony to some degree, but I'll tell you the story, I got sober.
Yeah, okay, let's go there.
Blow your mind. I used to run like kids' youth programs, right? Yeah, after a bender. But I used to run kids' youth programs when I used to go to them when I was 16 and then I was helping run them by the time I was in my early 20s. And it was awesome. It's a week on the Gold Coast, like a non-for-profit youth program my dad started. So I helped him run that. It was beautiful. We had like hundreds and hundreds of kids come over, 16 to 26-year-olds, 2,000 of them over 10 years. Anyway, and so they bring in the speaker and he comes in and he tells his story. And he was a huge drug dealer in a certain town in New South Wales, one of the big towns. And he had a come to Jesus moment. And not everyone has come to Jesus. Some have come to this moment, come to that moment. But he had a come to Jesus moment. His grandmother had prayed on him and everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he became an evangelical Christian. But he was also the biggest drug dealer in the town. He was also somebody, I could tell you all this stuff about him that would blow your mind where you're like, wow, that's like, some of that stuff is terrible. But he had a contract put out on him for his life and he had to leave the town. And he tells his story openly at churches and stuff. And he had to leave the town, but he was worth $35,000 at the time.
Oh, that was the price contract on his head.
And
okay.
And he was like, that was all I was worth? Wow. So he was given a green light to leave the town by his mate. He left, he came to the Gold Coast, started preaching at churches. Now, some people don't relate to that. I'm not into that. Doesn't really matter. It's the story, right? Mm. It's like you watch movies where you don't relate to stuff. Listen to this. So he comes to the Gold Coast, tells the story. He used to, you know, take girls and turn them into turning tricks and like crazy stuff through addiction. Crazy story. And so I hear this guy speak and I'm like, wow, that's someone I can confide in about how much of a hostage I feel like with my addiction. Because it was away from my family and this. And so we became buddies. We talked and he would ring up, how you going with everything, mate? When are you going to give it away? And I was like, oh, everything's good. It's fine. He knew. we read through the BS.
Yeah, of course.
You know, someone's dysfunctional, like, I can see how crazy you are.
Yeah.
And so I'll keep you accountable to that. So I start burning everything down. And in 2008, he comes and sits down with me on Robina on the Gold Coast. And he said, I see what's going on with your life. I hear about the chaos. He said, you're about to destroy every relationship in your life. Your parents are not going to, you're not going to have the relationship with them that you've got now. And so he confronted me with the brutal facts of my reality, that I was this close to blowing everything up. I don't know what happened. Bang, he got through to me. In that one moment, the tough love, I mean, he had his hand on the table and this was a 6'5" monster. And I was like, he's right. Now, I'd had that said to me before, but it was the right time. And he just said, you're destroyed. Look at this, the car, the this, the that, the money you owe, like the chaos, the drama. Look at the people, life. Like, oh, there was bikies running around the Gold Coast. Like, it was a cool period of time. What happens? I go to a meeting that night and I've never stopped going since. That was November 11th, 2008. I was scared into sobriety.
Wow.
Here's the best bit of the story.
Okay.
He went back into that world. And back into the craziness and back into the drama, back into the crime. And because he changed his environment to a different state, got back looking for a job, he got into security. And security took him back into the world. He's working in a church before that. I mean, he's gone from this world to church. Because he'd never dealt with the addiction. He'd never dealt with his stuff to that degree, in my opinion. So here's the bit that people always miss. You don't have to believe in God, right? I do, personally. But I'm not going to push it on you ever. It's important to me that I believe what I believe, but it's not important to me that you believe what I believe.
So important, yeah. Great differentiation.
I think God, universe, whatever you want to call it, works through people.
Oh, yeah.
There was a small window of time where he came into my life, helped me, paid it forward, and he went back out there. Now he's actually recovered from all that again, but what a window of time.
Yeah.
And the people go, I don't believe in anything. It's all, I believe in something because something helped me.
Yeah. It's those sliding doors moments in a way. I'm curious. So was he in recovery as well? And so your decision to go to a meeting that night, was that because you had seen your dad go to meetings? Okay, let's go there. Mm-hmm. You and I share a similarity in that we both have dads in recovery.
Yep.
I would love to know, during that period of crashing and bashing for you, was the fact that you had family in recovery a deterrent, or did that encourage you and was it a bit of a guiding light?
My dad had taken me to some meetings. Three months before, he took me to a meeting. He said, I'm going, I want it to Toowoomba. He came up to help me with this job I had at the time. And he's like, oh, do you want to come to a meeting with me? I'm like, cool. I went and listened. I was like, well, I was a bit close to home, some of that stuff. But like, no, I would never tell anybody what I'm going through. And so I'd seen him every Sunday morning. He would go to a meeting. Every, you know, Sunday night, he'd go to a meeting. This is through my addiction. So when my dad had his, was he now 47 years sober? What's 47? So when he had his year sober mind, it was like my last year of sobriety. Mathematics is a tension point, by the way. But it would have been his 30-year, something like that, the 32nd year. It was a big deal. That would have been his 30th. His 30th year, right? 17 years ago, I was 2 years off getting sober, and my parents invited me to come listen to Dad's 30th sobriety on Isla Capri on the Gold Coast. And I was like, yeah, I'll definitely come. Oh, I forgot. Like, I can't believe what happened, you know? And I just, but the thing is, I was a hostage to everything. So I would make commitments like that and I would break them. Oh, they were like, oh, it's a real shame you didn't come. I still regret not going to that because I was in addiction. I'd lie and cheat and I talked my way out of that. So seeing Dad as a reference point, because I think every person, you, me, whoever, needs a reference point. So I had the reference point and I went, oh, wow, they're sober. I can get sober. And I knew that the program was a solution to the problem I had. That's why I went. And I went and then I had their support through. Very powerful.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that. My experience was you touched on the bullshit radar earlier and I knew instinctively that I couldn't get one over my dad because he knew it. He lived it. He'd recovered from it. And so I found myself when I was in the depths of my addiction really pulling away, like to the point where I moved to another state so that I could really drink and use the way I wanted to. And every now and then I would burn my life to the ground and I'd get in enough pain for Dad to take me to a meeting. But the problem was I would sit there and it was like I had the cotton wool in my ears and I just didn't, nothing came through. I think I was so consumed with self-pity and like everyone must be looking at me and like nobody was looking at me. No one knew who I was, but it was all consuming. And then I would, like they say, I would hear the differences, not the similarities, and then I would leave, and that night I'd be drinking and using again. And it wasn't until I went to rehab and had about 10 days of sobering up and the fog started to lift that I was in a meeting and all of a sudden I identified for the first time. And that for me was like, oh, I'm in the right place. And not only do I identify, but I feel relief for the first time in over a decade because I know there's a solution.
Yep.
Like you said.
Yeah, well, that's the whole keep coming back thing. Keep coming back is you keep coming back until it clicks and you get it, because, you know, sometimes we just hear, but like we listen, but we can't hear. We don't have the maturity for it.
Mm.
That's why sometimes I go back and listen to podcasts from, just as an example, from 4 or 5 years ago. Like, I didn't hear that the first time. Well, I didn't even have the ability to hear that. So yeah. It's like that radar is like, I went around it and I was like, oh, you know, not for me, a bit too much God stuff, but this is the phase of life I was in. And later I come back and it's like, oh, wow, now I'm in enough pain that my ears have actually opened up. And I'm so much looking at the gift of desperation. So you get the gift of desperation, the ears open up and you're like, I will do whatever. You mean I've got to go to a meeting every day for 90 days? It's one of the little things, not in the book, but it's one of the things they talk about. Go to a meeting every day for 90 days, do this, get it sponsored with this. I'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Whereas sometimes we're not willing to do whatever it takes. So we do whatever feels good in the moment. And the next thing you know, we relapse.
Mm.
So that's why that sobriety is such a critical period of time. But you also cannot, people who are struggling, I've got a friend he really needs, you should talk to him. I'm sure you've had that. Hey, I've heard you do that. That's one of the beauties of the podcast video work, is this is going to go out to the internet, to the abyss of the internet. Some people would argue and say, if I can get on this thing, oh, this is at the level of press, TV and film, that maybe we shouldn't be sharing this stuff. I no doubt you've had critics for that. And I thought about that and I went, you know what? We live in such an interconnected world. I guarantee from this going out there, people will contact me and ask me to help them.
Mm.
People have probably contacted you based on this and helped them. How do we get the message? Now, we're not talking about specifically the program we're in. We're doing that very specifically. Now, anonymity, sure. Like, could I relapse tomorrow? Yes. Could you? Does that mean the program doesn't work? Well, there's millions of people around the world who've worked it for longer than us and are more spiritually well than us. We just happen to be sharing this message on a medium because, hey, there is a solution if you've got a problem. And if you do, you can reach out to either of us and we would help you. That's how the concept and program works.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really funny when people are like, oh, you shouldn't share at that level on this and that. It's like, well, yeah, you shouldn't, but we are. And no doubt we'll help people because it could be a sliding door moment where they're on the internet and they search that, find that. So much vulnerability in that first period of time. So anyway, I've been answered your question.
Oh, Dom, thank you so much for going there. I really appreciate it. It is something that I've received clapback for, and people have opinions and I respect their opinions. They're allowed to have their opinions. But I'm also of the firm belief that if Bill and Bob were around today, they'd be on Instagram.
Yeah, they'd be getting interviewed.
They'd be sharing the message. Like, that was the primary purpose.
Yep. And the reason why people, you know, the anonymity at press level, whatever it is, and I think there is a degree of that, like this, we're not specifically talking about what program we're in. Now, we're in recovery. I haven't heard you once say the name of the group. That's smart. That's actually keeping the anonymity of what we're doing. We're in recovery rooms. Not even saying what program it is. But if you put two and two together, you understand. Now, the idea of this is like, why they don't want us to do that. The people who wrote the book 100 years ago, God forbid we could reveal. You know, that's a part of the book.
Yes.
More will be revealed. And it has, called the internet. And so when more is revealed, I'm like, okay, well, why did they say that? They said that because if you're 3 years sober, 2 years sober, whatever it is, you start up this thing like, hey, look how amazing I'm doing the sobriety. You relapse. You're now a reference point to why the program doesn't work.
For sure.
I get it. And that's why you keep the anonymity at that level. But at the same time, there's a balance in that too. There is a balance. Like, I'm now further along down the track. I share that I got sober through a recovery program. People go, wow, that's actually a solution there for my friend struggling. I'm going to get him to reach out to him or someone in that program. So it's a balance.
Yeah. It's a blessing and a curse, I find, the anonymity piece, because the more, for me, and the whole reason I started this podcast, Behind the Smile, was because when I was in the depths of despair, I was looking around and I couldn't see anyone that looked like me that was sharing my story.
Exactly.
And once I tapped into identification, like we touched on earlier, so much shame was lifted.
Yep.
You know, my ability to step in and own my story, it's the same reason why I publicly identify as an alcoholic, because I don't, like, it shouldn't be a dirty word, yet because there's this stigma associated to it because we don't talk about it. It fuels this negative bias. And so I'm so passionate about that. And I fully respect people who don't want to identify or go public. It's each to their own. But
the difference is you're not a practicing. You're a recovering alcoholic. That's the only differentiating thing I'd put on it is if you said to me I'm an alcoholic, I go, you're not keeping the keys to my house because I'm a recovering. I see people say I'm recovered. I don't say recovered because I feel like that's finite. Like I'm recovered. It's like, yeah, well.
Well, and that would, you know, then, well, we don't, maybe you don't need meetings. Maybe you don't need a sponsor. Maybe you don't need.
But for me, that's me though. That's some people say, I say that. You're no problem. Some people say that to go like, can recover. Well, I'm still recovering. I'm 15 years. There's a humility in that for me, not for other people. Other people like, oh, it's more black and white. I've recovered. Good for you. Like I still, man, I've still got the isms that are just knocking on the garage door. There's a gorilla in there waiting to just take over my life if I don't put it at bay. So I think it's good that, because I went to a meeting when I was 22 in Brisbane. It's funny, as soon as I got sober, my life actually got better. I got a job. It was 2008, GFC was happening.
Awesome.
I got a job in Brisbane in a firm, and I was going up to these meetings in Fortitude Valley. And let's just say that environment, Melbourne to there was very different. I was very inspired Melbourne. Brisbane at the time, this was 15 years ago, I was struggling to connect. Put it that way. I'd go to this men's meeting. There's a whole bunch of blokes. So I didn't really relate to them. There was no one my age. I was the youngest person in the room by far, 22. Everyone else was in their 30s or 40s. And I was like, man, can I really, no reference point. Everyone was older. Like I found another guy who was 30 and we used to go to this new thing called burger. Wow. You know, the Simply Grill before they had the low carb bun, right? And so I'd go to meetings with him. But what you're doing as a reference point is what I needed back then. There was no podcasts. There was none of this stuff where you could go, Russell Brand hadn't written his, like, if somebody is wanting to get sober and or wanting to, what is it? I think they need the program, even though they're not an alcoholic or an addict, but they need the program. I'll give Russell Brand's book, Freedom from Our Addiction. None of that stuff was out there at that time. And so that's, I think you're doing good work.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Dom. Thank you.
And
thank
don't worry
you
about what the critics say. They're going to say something regardless. They will, because I mean, they haven't got a podcast.
Yeah.
It's a reality. They haven't got this thing, that thing. And some would argue, well, I don't need that or whatever. I'm just, people's opinions are just, they just blows my mind. People are always going to say stuff. I've been in business 12 years. Everybody's got an opinion, whether it's good or bad, but like, I don't know.
I guess it comes back to when you put your head on the pillow, like, are you comfortable with the person you are and how you showed up today? And when we get to live in recovery and work a program, we're generally moving with a level of integrity that perhaps we didn't have before. So
exactly.
Over time, like I'm coming up to 4 years in, I think next week. And like it's still not always water off a duck's back, but it's getting easier over time. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, people say that stuff to me, like, "Oh, I'll say to you the criticism that I bet you've had, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong." And I'm guessing this shouldn't have a podcast at early in sobriety, probably three years sober, you know, 2-3 years sober. Like, oh, you know, you might be just been doing that to make money or whatever. Like all this crap that people say.
Yeah,
and it's like, you're doing good work. I've watched your show. I've listened to Aaron the other week, and I was like, you know, people I know are sharing their story. We need people to share their story to go, wow, look at all these reference points, because it's going to give me hope. If I don't have hope, I'm going to give up. I don't have a hopeful future. Therefore, I'm not going to push through the gritty, tough present to get to that hopeful future. So I think you're doing good work. Don't worry.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Not that you need my validation,
no,
but
I
sometimes you need
it.
People to remind you that, like, hey,
it's nice
it's all
to
good.
Have people in your corner for sure.
And you got to resist, and no empire is built through without resistance, building something that's really awesome.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
So you went in at 22 and you just touched on this thing called the isms. You've mentioned that a couple of times. So I kind of want to go there now. What I'd love to understand is at 15 years sober, you're not going to, God willing, pick up a drink tomorrow. You know, it would be a progressive over time, maybe dropping off, doing the things, and maybe, you know, none of us are fully immune. But you show up and go to meetings to treat the ism more than the desire to drink alcohol these days. And you came in at such a young age. What I'd love to know is, because I think this is all interlinked, is what are the things that you have learned growing up in recovery? Because essentially that's where you've done a lot of growing up, really, 22 for the last 15 years. What are the things you've learned that allow you to show up in your life today the way you do and to keep those isms at bay?
Yep. I like that. Yes. I was 5 years sober when I sat with a guy and I went through I'm not getting into the specifics of it all, but we went through a certain part. We got to look at your shortcomings and defects. And I did that, and I'd never done it that thoroughly before. And when we did, he brought to my attention that my shortcomings and character defects, most people just skip past that. It's like a sentence or whatever, and they go, yep, take them away from me. we sat and we went through it for a day and a half. What my character defects and shortcomings. And the reality is I found them through something called an inventory, but I didn't dig into them that to that degree. So we firstly identified those. But what were they? Okay, well, let's say 9 months sober, I lost the desire to drink. I did. I lost the desire for any sort of substance, anything like that. And I distinctly remember it. I was like, wow, I'm like alleviated of this. That was brilliant. Now I'm, where am I? I'm 5 years sober. This guy, we do a map of everything. Okay, well, what am I, what are the things, what are the isms that if I don't deal with, they're going to come back and choke me out at 7 years sober and I'm going to relapse. Number one, insecurity. Huge insecurity. Number two, people pleasing, driven by insecurity. People pleasing. That's one of my the things that I've got. Still pops up from time to time. Mm-hmm. People pleasing. I want you to like me. I want to be affirmed. I need affirmation. Right. I don't need it as much anymore. Karina's actually knocked that out of me, you know, in a good way. She's like, such a people pleaser. It's driving me. But I've sorted a lot of that out the long run. I probably sorted that out in the last 5 years. So for the first 10 years, I struggled with it. I'd commit to things not because I wanted to, because I didn't want to say no to you and disappoint you and want you to like me. But I want back then I wanted you to like me so much that then I would manipulate.
Mm.
I would manipulate my way into beating my insecurity by fixing it to feel affirmed and secure and certain that you like me. How would I do that? Well, if I found out you didn't like me or something about me, I would talk to someone and try to get them to feed information to you. And then I would try to, you know, I would overcompensate. I'd like a photo on your Instagram and be like, hey, that's really awesome. And like hoping that you like me and validate me. Pathetic, really. But it's pathetic because it's driven by my insecurity. And what's my insecurity driven by? Well, the two fears that everything's driven by. But I won't be enough and I won't be loved. I won't be enough and I won't be loved. Then I'm not going to be whole. But everything's fine. Like I'm enough and I am loved. But those two things are the big things we fight, which drives the insecurity. It drives the manipulation. It drives the all of that. And so I found out that stuff. That's my isms. And even now I still act out on that stuff, but only from time to time versus all the time.
How can it play out these days?
Ooh, it's a tough one. I give an example. 2 days ago, a guy asked me, are you cool if I do this? And in the moment, I was like, yeah, that's fine. All good. It wasn't really a big deal. I should have gone, oh, let me think about that. I'll come back to you. Because I didn't want to disappoint him because he was asking if he could do something. It wasn't a massive thing. But then 2 days later, he said, oh, this and that. And I said, actually, now I've had to think about it. That probably wasn't the smartest agreement from my side. He said, why didn't you say it at the time? And part of me wanted to go, well, you should have given me more time to think about it. No, that's BS. Mm. Part of me is I didn't want to disappoint you at the time because you looked really happy about it. Now I look back and I'm like, that wasn't the smartest idea. It wasn't the worst thing, but that's how it plays out. Very marginally.
Mm.
But he said, I wish you had told me at the time. So I've got to then call him and say, hey, look, the reason I didn't want to disappoint you. Really happy. Probably a bit of people pleasing. I apologize for that. That's on me.
Yeah.
Not you should have given me more time to process. Why'd you put me on the spot? No, that's victim. This is extreme ownership.
Mm.
So that's what the business world has taught me. I read Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willick. And I'm like, I have to take ownership of why am I, you know, what about in my relationship? It's like we're like, oh, I'm a guy, so I do something, I think I get something. You know? Because that's how we work. That's how things work. Like if I it's like, oh, I did something good. Now I, it's like, no. It's like, it's deposits and withdrawals. I do one deposit, but I've done 15 withdrawals. I'm paying interest. I don't even know you. So I haven't done enough deposits. And like, this has happened in the last week where I, you know, something happens and I'm like, oh, look, I've done this great thing. I cleaned all this and did this. And I'm expecting like you're the most amazing husband. Oh my gosh. Wow. Gold, more than a gold star. All this stuff. Right. And then it's like, but the reality is I've withdrawn so much in the week before that. But I don't remember that because I'm in my needs.
Yeah.
I'm not in like I, you can never see the picture when you're in the frame.
Mm.
Never. That's why I have third party person helping me that I get perspective on and they go, hey, that's just self-centeredness. Kidding me? Why? Where did that expectation come from? Mm. This is where mentorship or sponsorship or whatever you want to call it comes from where someone goes, you are so self-centered. Are you really that much in that moment that you're like, my needs to be met here? When for the last week you haven't met this need because you've been thinking about yourself and fulfilling your needs.
Mm.
That's so difficult. That's how it plays out now. Mm. But none of that involves like, oh, I didn't get my needs met. I'm going down to St. Kilda. I'm going to go find someone who can score. It's not in my periphery.
Yeah.
That's how it plays out. But if I don't have that third party and I don't have a program to work, then it can build. Mm. And then when it builds, then I start to get dysfunctional. And when things get dysfunctional, they start to come apart. Now I'm in trouble. I'm 2 years down the line. I've overspent a heap of money. I've done this. I'm in debt. Things are happening. Now I've got life pressure now I'm looking for something to alleviate the pain. It's the unintended consequence of my lack of spiritual health 18 months ago.
Right. Wow.
It's a compound effect. Works backwards on you.
It absolutely is. So you and I both are in relationships with sober alcoholics, people yep. that are in recovery.
It works.
My relationship is 2 years and yours is a lot longer. So I'm curious. I'm asking this personally. I want to understand, because essentially we're taught in our program that one of our core issues is this selfishness and self-centeredness. Mm-hmm. So when two people come together.
Because that's how they come together.
Who, right. Of course, right? Yeah. Well, I won't do the hand gesture for the other one.
Come together as one.
Come together in unity.
Yes, unity.
So, I mean, how do you guys navigate that? Because I'm thinking that both of you at times would have that desire to have your needs met. How do you, is it sponsorship? Is it guidance? Is it like, what is it? How do you guys work on your issues today? And how has that evolved over time?
Oh, man. It's evolved a lot over time because we've evolved a lot over time. We're not evolving. It's like, man, what are we doing here? This is crazy. It's an interesting one because self-centeredness, we're all self-centered. I'm self-centered, she's self-centered, you're self-centered. Everybody is centered on self because the number one need of everybody is self-preservation. And then, of course, our needs go up from all the way that to enlightenment, whatever power versus force calls it, the hierarchy of needs. Mm. And so I think now we're mature enough to be self-aware. Like that took me about 12 hours the other day to process through something. So heated at the start. My needs weren't being met. Then I was heated about it and resentful about it. And then I came off the back of that and I got perspective. I was like, wow, man, I can't believe how self-centered I was being here because I can get the perspective faster. Whereas, and now I go like, oh, wow, I need to pull myself back from that. Why am I slipping into self so much again versus thinking about others? Because the thing is when I'm in flow, when things are really good and the needs are being met and the love languages are being met, it's like this, everything comes back. All the needs get met from both sides. And then we have harmony. When we don't, trip over each other, we get frustrated, we get short with each other, passive aggressive, all these little acting out things, which are really a symptom of the root cause of like love and respect. Mm. Want to be loved, men want to feel respect, women want to feel loved. And how do they feel loved? Well, it's love language is communication, but the bottom line of it all is communication. Is when something comes up, we address it and we talk about it, either there or just a little bit later. A little bit later is probably sometimes too late, sometimes just the right time. Because sometimes you don't. This is the hard part. It's the dichotomy of relationships is whether you're in recovery or not. Like you have a disagreement about something. Sometimes it's not smart to solve it on the spot. You need to give it 24 hours. You need to wait. Other times it's like, hey, I apologize. Yeah. And so on. Now I've done that. I've done that. I apologize too quickly.
Mm.
Whereas it's like, it's actually not all me, partly her, or it's partly the other way around. And then other times it's like, I need to address and go, hey, I apologize. My tone wasn't right there. Like that's the balance. We're never going to get that perfect, but we can have harmony in it.
Totally. This actually, I'll share an example with you of something that happened just a few days ago in my relationship. And so I was triggered by something and I shut down and my partner leant in and checked to see if everything was okay. And I just was fully walled up. Like I couldn't give him anything. I was full body shut down. Meanwhile, he's sitting next to me on the couch, no idea what's just happened.
Yep.
Anyway, he gets up and walks into the bedroom because he's in space, which then triggers me even more because of a previous relationship where the person would abandon the situation. Now, in that moment, my old reaction would have been to storm into the bedroom, to duke it out, to, you know, have my voice heard, like get angry, do whatever I needed to do. And I just like, I knew instinctively that that wasn't the thing to do, nor was it what I wanted to do. And so instead, I put my shoes on. I left the house, I went down to the beach and I walked and I walked and I walked and I prayed. And then I found a quiet spot and I meditated and I used a meditation that was all about self-compassion so that I could connect back into my heart space because I knew I was activated. And I said to myself, I'm not going back home and walking through those doors until my desire to fight, to have my point heard has been softened. Now, this entire process only took 45 minutes and I was able to walk back into the house. A partner in recovery who doesn't hold a grudge or, you know, he just held space beautifully and we were able to then talk about what happened. And it's interesting because I was really embarrassed by what actually triggered me. And again, part of me in the past would have tried to have manipulated that situation to still kind of blame him in a way.
Of course.
When the reality was I got vulnerable I shared what had actually really happened for me, and he was able to just lovingly understand and not make me wrong either. And that's a beautiful, like that, all of that has been from the tools that I've been given in recovery. Yes. I wasn't at the point where I had said to myself, Ash, stop being selfish. So it was actually really helpful to hear your example there, because 100% I was being selfish. It was my needs, what was happening to me, my fear underpinning all of that. And so
What's interesting is the areas that trigger us are just showing us areas we need to heal.
Right.
So you're being triggered by the previous abandonment, the relationship, and the layer below that was the first thing you were triggered by. We don't need to go into it, whatever it is, but it's all you're getting triggered, because I hear that word a lot. I'm triggered by that. And I get it. There's certain things that I get triggered by, which is really, what is triggering? Triggering is just our fight or flight kicks in.
Activation.
Fear response. And what is it? Well, it's because it's something in the past that's happened that's now coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh, you haven't healed in that area. And when you do, this is me, I haven't healed in that area. But when I have, that thing will happen in 3-4 years time. And you'll be like, huh, I can't believe that stuff used to really bug me.
Yeah.
And now it's like, it's all good.
So how much do you pray for the removal of that versus talk therapy, DBT? Like, what do you, like, how do you approach those areas that need healing?
Depends on the magnitude of the what happened. Yeah, I had to do some stuff last year to work on some childhood stuff, something that happened, not with my parents or whatever, but I had to go back and work on that and how that affected me. I had to journal on it, do some archaeological stuff, because I realized that at 37, it's actually affected me a little bit more than I'm willing to let on. Or because I'm like, that was a weird thing that happened. Oh, actually, that wasn't great. That actually has affected how I manage relationships and so on. So I've done the work on that. But it depends on the degree of what happened and how much it's affecting me. Because it's like Gabor Mate, I saw you've got one of his books, great, great book, When the Body Says No. He has a concept where he says our personalities are generally formed out of a coping mechanism to deal with our childhood.
Oh,
why am I a mad extrovert? Why am I? Because when I was younger, my brother was 6 years older. He got a lot more attention than I did. So what I did is I became a mad extrovert to get attention. And when I realized that through being loud and through gathering the room and promoting and doing these things, I could get attention, people would talk about me, then that reinforced. So why am I full on extrovert? It's formed as a coping mechanism to deal with that in my childhood. And so I'm aware of that now because I read books and I listen to stuff and I hear things and I go, that's why I have the need for attention. That's why I have the need for you to like me, because I feel validated because my brother got more. It's not my parents' fault. That's just called family dynamics.
Totally.
You've got it. You've got the older brother. You've got this. You've got the whole family thing going on. It's like, what about me? What about me? It's self-centered me.
Yeah. You know,
it's wild. Wow.
It is, isn't it? So let's switch gears for a moment. You and Karina also run your business together.
Yep.
How does that work? You know, like, because it feels like from the outside looking in, your lives are really intertwined.
Mm-hmm, very.
How do you make that work?
Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes that's not a good thing, because you need a bit of separation, right? And I get that. That's why we don't go to the gym together. You know, it's like we live in the same place together. We haven't worked traditional jobs since 2019 for me, 2014 for her. So wow. Operating from home the entire time, up in each other's grill, talking all the time, hanging out all the time. And that's great, but she needs a bit of space. I don't need as much space, so I need to be conscious of that. Like I can be on all the time, running a business together. And we run a decent size one. We've got a business in 3 countries.
Yeah, that's like amazing.
And we've got a lot going on in demand in certain areas. So, and we have 2 children.
That's a lot.
2 little girls, 3 and 6, who need our attention. And we're trying to balance that and then trying to meet each other's needs while balancing that. And we don't get it right all the time. We just don't. We don't chase balance though. Balance is a myth that is sold to people. You buy their program, they'll help you find balance. Shush.
I've heard Brené Brown talk about this, and I love it. This idea of work-life balance is a fallacy.
Oh my God. How can you work 5 days a week, have 2 off, and even balance? You started out of balance.
Yeah.
Make sense?
Yeah, you're set up to fail.
How do you work 40 hours a week and get paid for 37 and a half? You're already out of balance. Like, this is ridiculous, you know? I just can't, People don't think about that stuff, though.
Mm.
We don't talk about balance. We talk about harmony. Sometimes we have disharmony. Other times we have harmony. And that's where things feel like they're going well. They seem to be. We've balanced our calendar out. We're doing this. Or sometimes we get well out of harmony and we try to bring it back together and fix things. So we get it right most of the time. We used to get it right half the time. And now we're pretty good with it. But it's all communication, checking in. How are you going? But planning's a big one. Talking about things. Me, and as a male, I can't speak for all men. Which doesn't necessarily make you a man, right? Man's not necessarily a male, because we won't go there. But the idea that I will under-communicate about something sometimes, planning, calendar, this, that, and that causes issues.
Oh, yeah.
I book things in. I don't consult. I do this because I get ahead of it. I'm a little bit forgetful, which is weird because I've got a great memory and retention. But then sometimes I have so much going on, the extrovert in me gets a little bit downside to my personalities. I get forgetful. Oh, I forgot about that. I'm so sorry, whatever it was. I had so much I was thinking about. That can cause issues.
Mm.
Yeah, for her, it might be under-communicating. It might be over. Everything's different, right? She's a good communicator. We have to make space to be able to communicate together because we've got a lot of people to talk about, check-ins, how this person's going, what's happening there, how's this business going, whatever it is. And if we don't do that, man, we can run into chaos.
Mm-hmm. And so is that carved out into like dedicated time?
Yep.
Like this is our work time. We're not going to talk about our family in this time or this is, or does it kind of all?
Yeah, we've been really good with having a planning session. COVID disrupted a bit of it because we were around each other all the time, right? And you're at home for like, especially in Melbourne, it's lockdown city in the world, it's ridiculous. We were at home all the time. So that messed up our planning a bit because we were always talking about stuff. But we had a Sunday night, we talk about what we did last week, what we're doing next week, anything we needed to check in on. And we kept that for years. And then during COVID, we do it like every day. We talk about this and that. So you're having a structured time of the week where you can talk it. I think every couple should do that. How's everything going? Just want to check in with you. Is everything good? You know, because otherwise you're sitting there and you're watching, you know, watching Game of Thrones together and you're like, you good? Yeah, I'm good. And it's like, we're not actually checking in, putting the thermometer in. We're just assuming the temperature.
Yeah.
Men will do that more. They'll be like, yeah, everything's, if it's quiet, everything's good. No.
Yeah.
I found out that when it's quiet, not everything's good. That's a terrible assumption.
Quite the opposite.
Quite the opposite.
I'm very much like that. When my partner gets home, I always make an effort to check in and say like, how is your day? Because I work from home or I'm online. My business is a lot online. And so where he's out in the world. And for me, it's so important to have that point of connection. And there'll be some days where I know he doesn't have a lot left in the tank. And if I don't get that back, I'm a little bit like, oh, like.
I need that. My needs aren't being met.
Just something. Just that point of, connection, reconnecting and checking in. How are you? Like, you know, that touch point I think is so important.
But
in addition to that, I love the idea of having scheduled time once a week where it's a little bit deeper. And or maybe it's like, you're discussing things that aren't so sexy. It's finances or it's
money's so important. So you know what the number one cause of divorce is?
I'm gonna guess money.
Marriage. Secondly, it's secondly, it's money. And so why wouldn't you talk about something that's the number one cause of divorce is money issues? So call it like a CEO meeting. We're co-CEOs of our life and our family. Let's check in. How's this going? And you overspending this, what's going on there? Oh yeah, sorry, good luck. I needed to get a knife. And whatever and all the crazy stuff is, all this. So we talk about that and we communicate. Talk about finances and we talk about relationships and we talk about the time stuff that where are we going, planning, doing this. That's really important. We do that regularly. Date night every Saturday night. Mm. Like you never ever get me to do anything on a Saturday night because that's a night that we have together.
I was going to ask about date night. So
every Saturday.
Oh, I love that.
For years, for at least since 2015. Every that's Saturday awesome. Night. Sometimes we go for dinner, we watch a movie. We often watch a movie at home on a TV show. We watch a few episodes off because we love movies and TV. We don't do that all the time because like, I can't be entertaining myself all the time.
Mm.
So Saturday night's our dedicated hangout time together, watch a show, do this, or go out and get a babysitter every Saturday. Yep.
Cool. And how do you manage each of your recoveries? Because another thing that we're told is recovery needs to come first.
Mm-hmm.
And with two little humans that you're looking after, and how do you guys manage and balance all of that?
Mm. I'll tell you mine. I won't speak to her program. But I can only talk about mine, right? What I do is I reckon I was so vigilant for the first 10 years with everything. And then I found the COVID lockdown factor really knocked me off. 2020, like I had so much going on. Our business went crazy and everyone wanted to talk, was available because everyone worked from home now, right? And so my capacity increased. There was such an intensity over that period of time doing online meetings plus online calls all day.
Mm.
So I'm doing sometimes 8 meetings a day during COVID, which I wouldn't normally do, but everyone, that's the only way you communicate. Normally we just have a chat, I'd see you at the gym or whatever, but now everyone wants to talk on Zoom. So I'm talking to people on Zoom living in Dan's Melbourne, and then it's like, okay, now I've got to do Zoom meetings. And I was just fried. So I drifted a bit during 2020 to 2022.
Mm.
I did, and not drifted enough that I was not going to come back, but like, you know, started going from, you know, a couple of meetings a week, one meeting to one every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks. And then I had to kick myself back. Pain always kicked me back into gear.
Mm.
Issues, this communication, blow-ups with Karina. She'd be like, you need to get like yourself under control. And so I had some issues in my last 3 years, but then I was able to bring it back to center. Like, okay, now I'm much more involved in the middle of it all, post lockdowns, post all the craziness, adrenaline of COVID. It's funny how I call it COVID. It's not actually COVID. It's the government bureaucracy response to COVID. That's what it should be called. All of that that I went through, once I came off the back of that, I'm like, wow, I need to get programmed back. And I think that's, people don't talk about that stuff. They're like, oh yeah, I work really hard. I've worked really hard in bursts. Other times I haven't had to work it as hard.
Mm.
And I've rested on my laurels and I've paid the price, which is normally relationship, tension with people, issues. You know, the next thing you know, like I'm in traffic and I scream at someone. Not often, that's very rare, but like some, because I'm not doing well spiritually.
Yeah.
Someone screams you out the window of a car because you didn't go through the red. They're not doing well spiritually.
Right.
And so how do I get alleviated from that? Back to the muscle pliability through the program.
Mm.
So I got much more focused on that. I read Drop the Rock, and that really got me back into, oh, wow, my character defects, shortcomings. Started putting my head back into the program.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, okay. That makes a lot of sense. And it is interesting, you know, I always look to older sober members and to almost like a little bit of a guidepost, or, you know, I often think of like walking in their taillights. And it is good to see that it looks different at different stages, and that's okay.
Yep.
But what I see consistently when people are well is when they're plugged in.
Yes, of course. Well, that's in everything, isn't it?
Right.
If we're doing all the habits and we're doing the stuff and we're showing up and we're consistent, but it's like the hardest part about all that is so many people go for intensity, not consistency. And like, I'll do like a meeting every day. I'm like, why don't I just do a few a week? Because I can maintain that. It's for me, every habit is about sustainability. Can I sustain it?
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I couldn't do, like with my schedule and calendar now, people go, man, you should be doing way more stuff. It's like, yeah, let's flip it around a little bit. Like, it's not as easy as it sounds trying to run your life and to do all these things and to be a good stand. Like, I'll do the best that I can, and I'll show up the best that I can. And for me, that works.
Yeah.
For other people, they might need more. You know?
That's a great segue into habits. I want to talk about habits with you because I know that you have built your life on a foundation of really solid habits. Mm-hmm. As a type A extrovert, I'm not saying you are. I thought so.
Good assumption.
So I think we're very similar like that. I can almost be a little too hard on my habits. So how do you, what are your habits? What are the key things that you can't live without? And how do you put them into your life in a way that still allows for space and fluidity?
It's good. I like it. I think about the philosophy of habits first, though. How's a habit been formed? Well, I think it comes from a formula: input, thoughts, actions, habits. So what we put into our mind is massive. Who we spend time with, critical. If you hang around with dogs, you get fleas. Right? We know that. It's like, you've ever heard the bad company corrupts good character?
Ooh, no.
Never heard that? That's one of the greats. Bad company corrupts character.
Yeah, I like it.
I went from good school kid to bong smoking skateboarder, listening to Linkin Park. How did that happen? Bad company, good character, corrupted. And so my input, so I listen to podcasts, I read a lot of books. I flood my mind with a lot of stuff that's positive, right? And some people go, oh, well, that's not reality. Well, it is my reality and it works for me. And I'm a pretty happy person because I've completely cut out all the crap. Like I don't read fiction books, for example. People go, man, you're missing out. I'm like, I watch fiction. I read nonfiction. Like I just, like, man, what am I doing here? I'm reading all these stories about things that aren't even real. It kills me. And so I read a lot. I listen to a lot. I don't watch the news. Sometimes I'll check in on a couple of things that might be affecting business, supply chain, this, that. A couple of things I'll check in, like I was when Israel and Palestine happened, I was like, wow, that's a thing of interest. Like, what's this? Wow, it's heart-wrenching, all that stuff. But I haven't stayed in it because I don't have a solution for it. I can't fix it. Otherwise, I'm doom scrolling. And none of that stuff is helping me, helping the people in my life by me being in the middle of all that. Now, if I was from one of those countries, I would probably be a lot more immersed in it because that's how humans work, right? When we're affected by... I have been affected by that, like all of us have, but we're so far away from it. If I spend every day doing that, I will literally get anxious and I'll get depressed. And that's not going to help you. It's not going to help my family, my wife, no one. And so the idea of that is my inputs. I'm huge on that. Like I guard the ear gate, the eye gate massively. And then of course that changes how I think. Thinking's everything. Thinking's make or break. Thinking's a habit. People go, oh man, well, like how are those habits? Like I've lost 12 kilos in the last year, right?
Wow.
Tremendous amount of weight and kept it off. But it took me 15 years to get my thinking right around nutrition. Years. And it all dropped. Like 12 kilos is a lot of weight.
It's
like,
a huge amount of weight.
None of my stuff fits properly anymore. All my suits are getting taken and everything. But it took me 15 years to get the mental breakthrough to then in about 4 months lose the majority of it.
Wow.
Crazy. because I was willing to let go of sugar. Come on, man, I've given up all this and this.
Things that would be way harder, you would assume. Yeah.
Sugar's the most addictive thing on the planet because we eat it every day. It's in everything. And then I get off it. I detox when I come off it. But anyway, the point is I changed my thought process around it all. I had to because I had a stomach problem. Had to change my diet. It was not like, I want to change my diet. I want to look like Kayla. It's what I wanted, this, all this stuff. I had to out of necessity. That's called rock bottom. And when we have rock bottom, then we change out of necessity, not luxury. The next thing you know, I cut out bad carbohydrates and sugar. All this weight drops off. My energy goes up. I'm getting up earlier. My life transforms out of necessity, not luxury. Then what happens is my habits change. Next thing you know, I got a better life. Input thoughts, actions, habits. So I even think about that with the food factor. And so habits to me are everything. Do I have bad habits still? Absolutely. Do I finish people's sentences from time to time? Yes, because I think I know more than you know sometimes. That's one of my defects of character. Do I interrupt you? I haven't today. But I interrupt people? Yes, I do, because I'm impatient and I'm extroverted and you're talking for a long time and I've got stuff to say. These are things I'm aware of, so I temper myself back from, because I have a filter now. That's called maturity.
Yeah, right. So fascinating.
But it's habits, right?
100%.
It's all habit. Atomic Habits, best book.
Yeah.
Compound Effect, Atomic Habits. But I live my life by systems and structures. I write out a list of 6 things I got to do every day. In fact, now I've taken it to another level. Power, purpose, production, and passion. Power. I write 3 things I'm going to do. Like this morning, I was going to do CrossFit. I had a made over, so I decided I'd do it later. I had to do some stretching, and I'm going to do some sort of like meditation, right? Purpose. How am I going to build my mind? Okay, I'm going to listen to this specific podcast. I planned it all the night before. I'm going to read this specific book. I'm going to do this specific thing to build my mind. Production. How am I going to build my life and business? So I've got, you're on my production list today, things I've got to do. Then I've got to get some stuff fixed. I've got to pick up a few things from going to Perth. And then passion is, how am I going to invest into my wife, my kids? So what can I do? Power, production, purpose, passion. And I write it out every day, the night before, so I can execute on it. And if I start to get caught up in the whirlwind of crap in my life, which is bad habits, then I go back to the areas I've got to prioritize and execute on. Just a system.
I love that. I feel like that's a beautiful takeaway that people can start to implement into their life today, because at the end of the day, it's a choice, right?
Yep.
We all have a choice. Dom, I have loved having this conversation with you here today, and I feel like we could talk for another hour, but I'm mindful of the time.
Oh, yes.
And there's one final question that I always love to ask my guests who join me here on the show. I'm going to ask you that now. It's a perfect flow on from this idea of habits. What are your 3 non-negotiables that allow you to live your life today happy, joyous, and free?
3 non-negotiables. I love that. That is awesome. Man, I think about that. That's incredible. My relationships. Well, sobriety is one. I won't compromise on that, of course. But I don't get tested to compromise on that so much. Let's talk about stuff that I do get tested on to compromise. Well, I'm not going to compromise on my relationships. I'm a very high relational person. So my relationship, my wife, my kids, any of that stuff, I'm not going to compromise any of that stuff. Secondly, I'm not going to compromise my health. And I mean, like, I'm so into fitness. Now, funny things, I've been into fitness, but not been as much into health.
Right. Meaning, like, difference.
I'm exercising all the, I used to do CrossFit 6 days a week and I still had a front bump. You know, I'm still walking around. I'm overweight and whatever, chubby. And now, like, now that I've got my health right, I won't compromise on relationships, my health. And like, to be fair, like, I'm pretty mad into my business.
Yeah.
Like that's a huge part of my life, is because it's where I get my purpose and fulfillment from as well. You know, people go, business is just selling stuff and doing this. No. Like my business is all people. And so I won't compromise on like investing into relationships with people. Like I often have mates who go, man, would you come to the UFC? Would you do this thing or do that and whatever? And I'm like, look, I know it's on a Sunday, but that's like time when I'm having calls with people doing things. And like, that's my time to invest into people. And I really believe in investing into people. So I'm not going to compromise. I'm not going to do stuff of pleasure now when I'm living in duty and purpose.
Yeah.
So they're my 3 things.
I get that. Thank you so much for sharing.
And that's a hard thing that people who aren't in business don't realize. It's like, if they feel like some people feel like they're sacrificing. You know, I'm sacrificing my life, like, and all this. But like, I quit drinking and drugs at 22. Like, I sacrificed my entire friendship group. I went from Frank the Tank to the guy that no one wanted to hang out with because I was boring and wouldn't do this. And I was like, we're going to have a coffee on the weekend. Oh, I'll come out for it. So like, it's not a sacrifice for me. Sacrifice is when you're doing something of, you're giving up something of higher value, something of lower value.
Yeah, right.
That's like, I take my weekends, my non-productive time, and I've invested it into building people within a business through 3 countries. So I'm not going to give that up for for stupid entertainment stuff.
Yeah. And I think as well, when you're doing something that feels aligned to your purpose, like when it sets your soul on fire, it doesn't feel like work. It
doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm with you. Thank you for the chat.
Oh, of course, Dom. So if people want to find out more about you, check you out, where should they go?
Instagram. Just Dom McKenna. Two M's. Dom McKenna. Easy.
Brilliant. I will link that in the show notes. We say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs suffer in silence. So thank you so, so much for your time here today, Dom.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Sure.
A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.